And so a big question we get is, how much revenue loss do you typically see? And actually, we don't. When the transition plan is handled correctly, we actually see revenue growth, at least for the first, 12 months out of it.
The time will pass. The 10, 15, 20, 25 years will pass. If you build a $500,000 law firm, it's a job. If you build a $5 million law firm, it's a retirement.
You're listening to the Grow Law Firm podcast, where each guest shares actionable, practical ideas with you on how to get more clients, expand your reach, and grow your law firm's revenue and profit. Here's your host, Sasha Burson.
Hi there. I have a small but really meaningful favor to ask you. You know, I watch At The Stats on our YouTube channel and Spotify channel, wherever most people listen and watch our podcast. And I see that over 80% of everybody who listens to it regularly is not a subscriber. I'm asking you to subscribe to this channel. And the reason for that is my mission and the mission of my team is to help as many small law firm owners to learn how to transform their law firms into better businesses, and so they in turn enjoy better lives. When you hit subscribe button, you tell these platforms that this is content worth listening, worth viewing, and they in turn will show it to many other small law firm owners and hopefully help me fulfill our mission of helping them create a better business and enjoy better lives. So would you please do me this favor? It would mean the world to me. And hit the subscribe button. And my promise to you is that I will continue to work hard at creating good content with practical ideas that help you and your teams grow better law firms. Thank you. Welcome to Grow Law Firm Podcast. Today, I have an incredible guest here. Tom Lenfasti is the founder and CEO of the Law Practice Exchange. I believe it is the first marketplace for law firm owners to buy and sell law firms. He is the prayer. He is the answer to the prayer that I've been asking for years. I've been wondering, why hasn't there been a true marketplace for lawyers to buy and sell law firms? And a few months ago, we came across the Law Practice Exchange, and I'm very excited to have Tom on the show. Tom, welcome to the show.
Yeah, Sasha, thanks so much for having me. And those kind words, and we're glad to be here and, help be the marketplace for hopefully creating continuation plans for law firms, right? Lawyers build value when they own their businesses, and we're here to help preserve and transfer that value. So excited to discuss with you.
What did you come up with the idea of the marketplace specifically for law firms, which I believe there are some consultants, but never have I ever seen a marketplace for law firms, which I think, once again, it's way overdue for one.
Yeah. Honestly, Sasha, a lot of my thinking started with a book called Built to Sell that I
love that book.
Yeah. And John Warlow. And I probably read it, 15 years ago now. As I was a practicing lawyer, owned my own law firm, helping other professional businesses like CPAs, dentists, transact and sell their firms. And as we were talking about before we went on air, jealousy probably led me a little bit of watching these dentists, build a practice, hire a, practice broker, market the opportunity, find a good next generation attorney to buy it and help them really fund retirement, but also to preserve that value that they built, whether they were in a major city, a suburban area, a smaller geographic market. They could sell and transact and really have an exit strategy. And I think especially as business owners in general, having that option of, wait, I have an exit strategy, right? As employees and everything else, there's always the walk away. But as business owners, especially, it's having a true exit strategy. And I think, the excitement for that for me years ago was, look, the associate buy, the internal buy for law firms has been really discussed a lot, but not all firms have that internal associate. Actually, a lot of small law firms do not, or those internal potential associate buyers aren't interested in buying. And so a marketplace was really needed to do that. And that was the goal, is to create a marketplace similar to what had been built over years for CPA and accounting practices, for dental practices, insurance, financial advisors, the other professional businesses that had done it, the goal was to do it for law. And that's really been our focus and our charge over the last several years.
Yeah, I find that almost for every service business, there is a marketplace, and now there is one for lawyers. And as you and I have talked before we started the recording, the legal world is, as usual, somewhat behind so many other industries. I think it was way, way, way overdue for something like this. I wonder, why is it? And I've had so many conversations with law firm owners, hundreds. And I would ask them things like, what's your exit strategy? Most of them do not really think about that. It's kind of like a forever job. And by the way, I'm speaking at a conference next week and talking about very common problems that lawyers experience. And I compiled a list of what I've heard from so many, again, hundreds of small law firm owners, as well as I dug around Reddit for frequent answers to the question, like, what are the common challenges that you as a law firm owners experience? And here are a couple of them. I work long hours, and while I still like it, I don't find the job that satisfying anymore. It just seems depressing to think that this is it. I'm the principal of my firm, but I don't really build anything. Like I've heard these things before, and I read them on Reddit. Here's my list. And it's so commonplace. And I always think about it, like, if you get yourself into this forever job or forever business, you are the principal. Like, it's like marriage. If you don't do anything new for 20 years, guess where it's going? It's going to get very stagnant. And thus that comment, I work long hours, and while I still like law, I don't find the job that's satisfying anymore, the job of being a lawyer within your own law firm. So I always think that the marketplace, buying another law firm, gives you a very different level challenge, right? Where you can start flourishing again because you're working on something new, something exciting.
Absolutely. And you know, again, a lot of our sellers, some of them aren't done practicing law. They're just tired of running their firm. Mm-hmm. Or their firm is really running them. You mm-hmm. know, there is too much work. They don't yep. have, you know, enough bandwidth as far as associate attorneys. So a lot of our deals, we tell everybody, you know, the ownership may change, but that, you know, selling attorney who used to own the firm, they may stay on practicing for years to come, because that then real kind of reignites their love for law, or they never lost it. They were just burdened from the management, you know, the up and downs, the payroll processing, the financial, you know, responsibilities of it. And so, yeah, Sasha, I think overall, a lot of that burden, like, we've had the opportunity, not just with senior attorneys, but, you know, with 35 to 40 year old attorneys who have built good firms, and for one reason or another, are ready to exit and to stop and to move on to something else. We've had attorneys who have moved on to software. We've had attorneys who have moved on to consulting. And of those firms, the nicest part that I think we've been able to do is, you know, allow them a springboard to do so by monetizing their practice, right? So they've been able to say, look, I'm done here, but, you know, I need the financial benefit of, you know, continuing that forward. And so a sales strategy allows them to, you know, gain that financial benefit, move forward. And I think that's a huge part, especially as lawyers have such an emotional, you know, tie to what they do, is, you know, providing an exit option. And then to your point of, you know, buying a practice. Hey, if you think you've conquered everything and you're doing great and you want a new challenge, well, grow your revenues by $1 million overnight, right?
And buy that revenue, buy that cash flow. Yeah.
That's right. You know, buy a new geographic market, which is a big thing, you know, for our plaintiff firms and other firms, is really, you know, going into different markets, taking over brand, but then it's integrating the team, integrating the marketing brand, right? The different systems. How do you really do that? Or are you managing different brands? But a lot of times that does, to your point, reignite and say, okay, you know, I built my firm. I've kind of got this on a good balance, but I'm just bored, or, you know, just not feeling fulfilled. Well, acquisition can definitely drive a new excitement because you see the growth immediately, right? And you see, maybe you're a good manager, less on the practice of law. Well, it's, you know, ready to take over and, you know, see what management skills you can deploy in that acquisition. Absolutely.
Makes perfect sense. I haven't shared this with you, but earlier, when I was way younger, I started a business in financial services with a partner of mine, brilliant guy. We built it up to low eight figures. And after 8 years, I was just like, the stress level is insane. I hate this thing. I'm going to sell. And I did.
Right.
And it was one of the happiest days in my life. And fast forward a few years, I really wanted to get into the marketing business. I never dreamt of, well, I did dream of starting a marketing company, but I was like, I don't want to do this. I'd rather buy an existing cash flow with a team with a lot of process set up. So this brand, I just bought into it, an existing company that had 10-year proven track record. It's a lot easier to buy than build. A lot easier. There is a book actually by the title, Buy Then Build. It's a great book. Highly recommend it. If you're entertaining going up a different level, doing something else within law, you can start buying other law firms. It's fascinating how not terribly difficult it is.
Absolutely. And I think from a lawyer side, there's always, as lawyers, we're trained to be skeptical. We're trained to, you know, see all of the things that could go wrong before we see the things that can go right. And I tell people, I think that's how they really teach us in law school.
Yep.
You know, you read bad facts in bad cases, and that creates law. And so that is, you know, when we talk to a lot of lawyers early on, they would say, oh, I don't think my practice has value without me. Right. It's me. And, you know, we do.
Probably true in many cases. Sorry to interrupt. But
absolutely.
Like if you're a solo, like, what do you sell?
Yeah, absolutely. And really, our overall goal on a structure is a transition based sale. And so we tell everybody
this isn't
a throw of the keys transaction. It's not if I'm selling my firm and I built it up through personal referrals in my community, going to Rotary Club, you know, different civic events, you know, these different volunteer activities. And I have a new attorney come in who's going to take that over. If I threw the keys to him and walked away and nobody ever heard from me, that value is going to deplete pretty quickly. And so ours, you know, as a transaction, the only thing we really encourage and try to do are really more of pass the baton. And that means as a seller, I'm going to stick around and I'm going to introduce my buyer to my Rotary Club, my civic communities, my key clients, my referral sources. And as I do that, I'm taking a step back, right? Moving to part-time after a sale or anything else. You know, from a financial services side, a lot of times that's the way it has to be handled to retain clients, right? CPA side, otherwise, a lot of similar models, because clients really want to be cared for. They don't want to be surprised. And if I were to throw the keys to somebody and they're like, wait, who are you? Surprise will create loss of value. But when I can really introduce and say, hey, meet my chosen successor. To take care of you, client, I went out and looked for a successor to make sure that this community or these clients or these referral sources can continue to be cared for. That message works really well, right? And usually drives actually revenues coming out of that. There's referral sources we haven't talked to in years. There's other things that can kind of be unleashed from database emails and everything else that really can help drive revenues through a good transition. But overall, yes, it is not for a lot of law firms. It has to be handled with care to transition and pass that baton carefully to announce to your key referral and revenue sources the right way to do it. Others, as you probably know, are very digital marketing heavy, right? They've done the right things. The owner is not involved in marketing. They have a good team, everything else. And so those are a little bit closer to throwing the keys and walking away. But you still have to integrate team management, culture, you know, handle that piece with care. But definitely, it's a different type of transaction, mostly for a lot of solo small firms where there's a lot of personal value or, you know, to the individual attorney compared to firm value like website, brand, you know, those digital assets that really produce. But combine those both together, and that's really what you want to focus on preserving and handing over to a potential buyer. And successfully, you know, when we have the right parties and they can communicate effectively, it usually will jumpstart so that revenues increase after a transaction because you see bandwidth open up. To your point earlier, you see energy, right? You know, a lot of times that seller is just tired. They don't have the bandwidth. They're working less. They're just, you know, everything else. And when they bring in a new buyer, a new firm that has all these resources, all of a sudden just revenues can grow. And so a big question we get is, how much revenue loss do you typically see? And actually, we don't. When the transition plan is handled correctly, we actually see revenue growth, at least for the first, you know, 12 months out of it, we see a jump, because the buyer usually is going to focus on things like email database, which under a traditional law firm, you probably know this too, a lot of our small practices haven't talked to their database at all. They haven't emailed them at all. And so when you start emailing and saying, hey, we're very excited to merge and be part of this, you know, great new firm, come to this open house, attend this webinar, go through these, we see revenues grow, you know, right out of the gate from that, which is usually pretty good, because a lot of the, you know, sell structures as far as payment terms sometimes are, you know, contingent upon performance. And so if you're a seller, you want to make sure, yes, I've got an email database. Let me help you buy or see this. And yes, we should have an open house. And yes, I should introduce you to all my good referral sources, because if all those stay and all those produce good revenue, usually under a performance-based payout structure, you're going to, you know, turn out better as a seller. And everybody wins. Buyer wins, you win. It's a good thing overall.
So let's think about it from a buyer standpoint. Let's say that you and I decide to partner up and buy 2-3 law firms within the same geography, more or less, to get a share of a market. Let's say we look at a mid-sized city like Charlotte, North Carolina. It's about 1 million residents, give or take. So not something as big as Chicago where I am, but Charlotte, 1 million people, very decent sized market, very conquerable, depending on the practice area, probably not in the PI space, but in other spaces, probably.
Sure.
So, and we have some money set aside for down payment and some operating for an operating account. What practice areas would you focus on and why? What would be the valuation model that we would be applying to those potential acquisitions?
Yep. I would focus, well, one, it's always, you know, what knowledge do we have as buyers, right? Or what knowledge do we have on our team? Because if you and I are in, you know, residential real estate, let's not go buy a personal injury practice, right? As our first step in that. Unless really, you know, there is going to be a seller mentorship plan, right? Like the seller, the owner is going to stick around and really help us. But again,
sorry to interrupt, but don't you find that super risky? Like that mentor can have a heart attack tomorrow.
Correct.
And there goes that plan.
Correct. Yeah. There's always contingency on the financials and anything else, but yes, you're absolutely right. So usually what we have, you know, as we were talking a little bit before, we have a lot of buyer demand, more so than sellers. But being a qualified buyer, and that's kind of what you're asking, is how can we really be a qualified buyer? Means we know a practice area, or we know what practice area we want to go for. Typically, Sasha, if you and I have experience, I would look at practices that have a systemized or systemizable, kind of process to them. You know, plaintiff firms like personal injury, workers' comp, you know, are some of those examples. SSDI, those are very active practice areas for us because they can be built in, right, to repetitive systems. Otherwise, they can be built so that they're not dependent on one attorney. They can be process driven through good automations, good teamwork, everything else that comes with it. Other areas, immigration is a big area for us, intellectual property, patent prosecution, things where really, again, you know, you have clients, but it's about, you know, doing the best work, but under hopefully a better business model. Things that may be complex M&A, where you are so reliant on the attorney that was leaving, right, to do that, it's a little bit tougher. Like they're going to have to transition for a longer period of time. You and I are going to make sure that the purchase terms and everything else are very variable. So we would look at, you know, practice areas that we know, practice areas that hopefully can be scaled under, you know, good systems from all the way from marketing down to operations, you know, down to the deliverable to the clients, because those are the ones that we can come in. And if they're not maybe system-based, we can help improve that, right? And that's immediate efficiency that we can bring to that, whether it's from a marketing side, otherwise. I always like firms, of course, that are going to be firm-driven, firm-branded marketing versus personal marketing. So if it's, you know, Joe selling his firm to us and it's all Joe's referral sources, you and I, or, you know, our team have to meet, you know, make sure Joe's referral sources are going to come over to us. Everything's going to work great. But if Joe runs a strong, you know, digital marketing brand, website, other digital marketing, has funnels with webinars, you know, email follow-ups and campaigns, and Joe says, I manage it all, but, you know, it just, that's where our clients come from. You and I would be easier, right, to transition that over to us, right? So hopefully that's part of the knowledge, but that's a system that he's built to really carry that forward. And then as far as purchase terms on those two different things, if Joe has a very personal-based referral firm, our purchase terms are going to be more performance-based, which means they're variable based on revenue success. As the revenue comes over to us upon a purchase, right? Joe says, here's my, you know, referral sources, here's the clients. We're going to pay Joe, but we're going to pay Joe based on retention. Typically, if, you know, retention, one referral source, one client drops off, right? Then Joe may not get as much from us as the buyer. So we're going to look for, you know, variability because that transition is more of a risk. On contrary, if Joe had, you know, that branded digital marketing proven, if he's got case inventory that he can show us, historical data, everything else, we're probably going to pay him a higher fixed price and probably a higher overall price. But our payment terms are going to be, you know, more of here, right? With maybe some margin for performance as well. But overall, as buyers, our risk is less because there's less transition risk in that deal than all of his referral source and clients under the other structure. Does that, you know, kind of give you a landscape on that?
Yeah. Let's dig in a little further into this. Let's use some examples. So let's say that Joe, who's been doing estate planning, runs some seminars, let's say once a quarter, attracts enough business that he generates $500,000 a year in gross revenue, pays himself $200,000 on W-2, and then at the end of the year, there's 10% net profit, $50,000 left. So seller's discretionary income, or earnings rather, SDE, is at this point $250,000. Most of the business still doesn't come through these seminars. It mostly comes through referrals. Joe wants to walk away. We definitely have an inherent risk buying this business from Joe. How do we value these $250,000? We don't care about the $500,000 revenue because we're not buying really revenue. We're buying the cash flow, that SDE, seller discretionary earnings. Like, how do we value this brand, this law firm?
Yep. The first thing we're going to do is we're going to look at that 250 that you said, you know, that Joe was making as far as, you know, his salary and his net income. And we're going to say, how much legal work is Joe doing? And on a $500,000 firm, Joe's doing all the legal work, right? Yes. He's it. He's the guy.
Yeah, he's it.
And so then what we're going to do out of that is say, okay, if Joe was going to hire a replacement, right? Because I tell everybody, it's a bad analogy, but you have to remember, lawyers are machines in the factory. You can't take a lawyer like Joe out and expect to maintain $500,000 in revenues. Or put another way, any buyer is going to have to come in, and if they're not going to do the work that Joe does, they're going to have to pay somebody to do the work that Joe does.
Yes.
And so under that scenario, not to complicate the math too much, but if 250 is our number and Joe's replacement salary, if he were to hire somebody with the sophistication and level needed, he was going to have to pay 150, right? So now, right, we have 100,000 left over. Yep. Like true 100,000 left over is what I call the true benefit of ownership, right? Every year, hopefully, if we can preserve that 500,000, there's going to be 100,000 left over. And in the market right now, which we tell everybody, we do market valuations. Our goal is not to value something for tax purposes or death or divorce or otherwise. It's really to sell. And in the and so we look to market comps that we've been building over the last decade to do so. And right now for that type of firm, right, Joe's multiple would be probably somewhere between a 2x that 100,000 or a 2.5. And that could be exciting to Joe. That could be less exciting to Joe. But part of the reason it's going to be on that, you know, 2 to 2.5. Yes, some businesses transact at like 9x. Law firms do not. But the overall aspect is, you know, let's say Joe's firm is valued at, you know, 2.5 of that. right? So if Joe's in that structure, but Joe's also got to stay around afterwards, you know, to work with us, to introduce referrals. He probably has to finish up some client legal work. And Joe's going to get paid for that, for his legal work that he's going to do. And so after purchase, we got to pay Joe something.
Are we going to pay him $150?
Well, maybe $150 if he stays on, you know, full time. And so again, you know, that's just taking, you know, your legal work, you know, your overall benefit of ownership down. And so that's why the multiples for a lot of small practices that are built like Joe's, that are built on, you know, referral with some outside marketing and webinar and otherwise, but the multiples are a little bit lower. One, it's, you know, not a public market. The only people that can buy Joe's firm are lawyers. And as you and I've talked about, you know, lawyers are risk adverse. And so most lawyers are going to want to see a good return on their investment for taking on the ownership risk, everything else. And then the multiple, you know, are compressed a little bit on valuation because the free cash flow after sale is going to be dinged a little bit by keeping Joe on to help us transition. And so, but overall, right, if Joe went into this and he was talking to you and I and said, I don't know if my firm has value, I'm thinking about winding it down. And we told him, hey, your firm might be, you know, 250, 300, you know, 1,000 of value. All of a sudden, maybe that's something that, you know, Joe wants to entertain, because it's not just that he can monetize that value and pull it, but it's really that he can have an exit strategy with a continuation plan, right? So that he doesn't have to figure out how to wind this down, transfer clients, you know, close it down, anything else. He can really step aside and let his firm continue forward. So the financial benefit's great, but usually it's easier than actually the wind down. And to your point, if Joe wants to stay on and be an attorney for $150,000, great. We have our attorney, right? And, you know, we'll kind of work with Joe for years to come.
But Joe probably will not want to stay, because this sounds terribly unexciting. He goes from making $250 to making $150, and he gets to walk away with $250 pre-tax. So really, after his taxes, right, it's a long-term capital gain tax, but he's still going to be like down to $200,000.
He is. Right? Yeah. So, but yeah, absolutely. Joe may not be excited, but Joe may also be one of those that's tired of management. And Joe knows he needs a succession plan and doesn't have it. And, you know, from that aspect is, for most of our sellers, values, as far as that small law firm, it's not the need for that financial exit price that's really motivating them. Yep. Openly, Sasha, it's typically, I want to spend more time with my grandkids.
Yeah.
Right. Like I still am okay with practicing law, but, you know, I want to spend more time with my grandkids. Or my significant other says, if I don't slow down and start traveling with them in retirement, like we're supposed to be, you know, they're going to kill me. And so we have a lot of outside motivators from that side. But on the flip side, you know, one of the things we haven't talked about is, you know, for a lot of our attorneys, especially business owners that have built this, it is an emotional challenge to think about selling, to think about lack of control. And you went through that, right? When you sold your financial services business. But, you know, when you potentially give up control, you're also gaining a lot of freedom. That control came with burdens usually, right? Burdens of financial and everything else. Yeah. So that's part of it.
Yeah. So super interesting. I think for those folks who are listening to this, and they may be very much like Joe, and granted, a high percentage of law firms operate in that $300,000 to $500,000 gross revenue range. I'm thinking probably around 40%, and here's how I'm thinking this. 5 years ago, there were statistics that 33% of all law firms, of all lawyers, work in solo law firms. That's like out of 1,350,000 lawyers, 450,000 were like solos, no other lawyers there. Probability that you're doing more than $500,000 in revenue by yourself, slim to none. Maybe you're an exception, right? And then another 33% or another 450,000 lawyers worked in small law firms between 2 and 10 attorneys. Those are typically, I see them, I talk to so many of them, under $2 million in revenue. So these are like very, very common scenarios. Now, here's what I'm thinking. For people who are like Joe, the numbers that you just talked about might be the wake-up call. right? A lot of people, business owners, not just law firm owners, but business owners think that their business is worth here, but the reality is it's here. Unrealistic expectation. Let's run through a different scenario. Let's talk about an uncommon law firm where Joe started this law firm 25 years ago, and he was actually into systems. So over time, he developed or he hired people who developed a marketing system and an intake system and an operation system and a management system. And he has all of those things in place. And lo and behold, he got to $5 million in revenue. Joe is truly the CEO of his law firm. He has other people working there. His net pre-tax profit is 20%. He makes a cool $1 million at the end of the year before paying taxes on it. And he pays himself generously $400,000 a year for being the CEO of this law firm. 25 years in, he's bored, he's tired, he doesn't want to do this anymore, he wants to move on to something else, he's ready to sell. What's the valuation for something like this?
Yeah, absolutely. So under that scenario, he's making $1 million, but he's not doing any of the legal production. So we don't have to worry about a deduction of replacement, you know, attorney or anything else for him. And, you know, if he's really built this practice, he's probably, you know, if he's in a plaintiff world, he's got some future revenues on the books, or he's got great numbers on his intake, his marketing, everything else that really are predictable, right? It's largely, here's what we've done historically on, you know, web traffic, conversion, intake, everything else. And so usually on those, Joe's going to be pushing, you know, a 3 and up multiple. So we're talking about, you know, he's going to have at least a 3 million purchase price, potentially up to, you know, 3.5-4 million. It really depending on, again, practice area, other things that kind of come with that. But the biggest thing for Joe under that scenario is his purchase terms are going to be significantly better than our previous Joe. Meaning he's going to get more money at closing just because, again, that transition risk, what we talked about before, is less. And he's really built that value overall. So the multiples will move. And then we have a lot of different types of buyers based on Arizona, ABS, you know, alternative business structure, non-attorney ownership, which are really going to push the multiples up for that Joe, our second Joe's practice. Mm-hmm. Because, right, if they can come in with attorney partners or anything else and, you know, take over that practice, the new Joe is a scalable practice, right? It's a practice that the systems have been built, and maybe we want to expand into new markets. Maybe we want to do more marketing, right, that Joe hasn't done because he got to a good place, but that's really a scalable business. And that goes back to Sasha, you know, my favorite, you know, kind of book, Built to Sell. You know, the lesson from that book is if you do everything and you haven't really built, you know, business value, business systems, business others, then really have you, you know, what kind of value do you have? You can go out and potentially, you know, sell that in one way or another, but the max value is going to come from investing in the business, right? And I think our, you know, our second Joe has done that. And he would have a lot more buyers at a better price. As far as multiples and everything else, and at better terms, because he's done so.
I so love it that you bring up Built to Sell book. I just realized, so right there, right behind me, that's my short library of my favorite books. The third book from the top, that one with that blue right there, yep. That's Built to Sell.
Oh yeah, I see it, yeah.
It's one of my, so these are my top 10 favorite books, and Built to Sell is right there. So be like the second Joe. This is my thesis. I get to talk with a lot of small law firm owners. And I'm like, the time will pass. The 10, 15, 20, 25 years will pass. If you build a $500,000 law firm, it's a job. If you build a $5 million law firm, it's a retirement. And you're going to retire either by default or by design. That retirement out of $5 million law firm is a lot cooler.
Absolutely.
Way cooler than retirement from a $500,000 law firm.
You know, and again, we've kind of adopted everybody, you know, every lawyer that owns a firm, you will sell your firm one day. You will. Like, life is going to function in a way that you cannot own it beyond, you know, health, disability, death, anything else. And so that sale, that transaction is coming. It's just a question of, to your point, what you've built, right? What is yeah. that value and how you're really going to transact it to see it? You might get zero, or you might get, you know, several million from it. And, you know, again, Sasha, not to talk about books, my other favorite one that's on my shelf, you know, low here is Traction. And one of the mm-hmm. core principles of, you know, Traction, as far as that book is, you know, delegate and elevate, which means essentially, you know, our second Joe, you know, he built systems and he delegated what he does to systems so he could really move into more of an owner seat to do so. And that's just such a tremendous way in law firms to take a traditional firm to really a high value firm, at least in the marketplace, is to, you know, delegate to people, to great people, which a lot of even the $500,000 Joe firm, he's probably got a great paralegal in there that could do a lot of other stuff and probably wants to stay on working after Joe retires for another 5, 10, 15 years. And so, you know, that can become an asset for him and kind of minimize some of that transition risk and other things. But our second Joe, I mean, he's built the systems. He's trained people on those systems. And so when you really do that, you're increasing the overall market value of your firm significantly. And it's amazing to me over the last several years being in this space of, and I'm sure you see the same, of just, you know, yes, we see the traditional, you know, first Joes. We see those. And they're out there and they've built great practices and they serve their clients and community well. And then we see these creative as hell business owners who have invested in, you know, systems 25 years ago or 5 years ago and, you know, built law firms that, you know, really kind of run with their management, but without them in it at 60% profit margin, you know, and really carrying forward.
Gross profit margin, gross, not net.
Yes,
gross. I just want to make sure we're clear about that. Right?
Yeah. But I mean, just tremendous, tremendous, you know, and they're outliers. Right. But it is amazing once you invest in marketing, you invest in operational management and systems and client services and software, like really what can happen. And I think one of the biggest things, of course, about Built to Sell as well, that book is, you know, once you build a better firm, not only is it more marketable and more value, but it's just more fun to own. It's a better, you know, lifestyle firm where you don't, you know, run yourself ragged. You make more money with hopefully, you know, more consistency and, you know, less stress. And so that's also part of it is enjoy it, build to better, right? Overall, but build, you know, that firm that you want to sell, but hey, enjoy it for a few years while you can continue to own it and, you know, maximize the profits and go from there.
100%. There's one thing that you said that I do not disagree with fully, and that is, the second Joe did not build those systems. It is impossible for Joe to build those systems because Joe is not an expert in marketing. He is not an expert in intake. He might be really good at operations because Lobo is what he does. He may be a really good leader. I think the way second Joe got to that $5 million in revenue is by bringing a lieutenant who knew marketing, and that's his director of marketing. The second person that he hired was a director of intake who really understood sales, and that person built him an intake system. And he probably fired himself at some point by delegating operations to another person who was in charge of operations. And Joe, the second Joe, stayed at the captain's helm. He steered the ship in the right direction, and that has been his job for the last few years. And I can tell you firsthand, it's a way better lifestyle. If you're standing at the helm, instead of wearing multiple hats, you're doing marketing, or at least you're in charge of hiring people for marketing and then firing them and training them and asking for all the reports. And then you're also in charge of intake and you do cases while doing other things. And also this person needs to be hired and this person needs to be fired. It's insanity. So the second Joe probably got the right lieutenants in the right places. He has been enjoying a relatively smooth sailing for years. And that's why the buyer would be willing to give him such a higher premium for buying the business because, well, it's set. The team is in place. It's that
Absolutely.
Much easier.
Absolutely. We had a firm client a few years ago who hadn't been in corporate offices in something like 9 years, made $10 million a year in net income.
Yeah.
You know, and their overall, you know, role and responsibilities is like, well, what do you do on a daily basis? And they say, well, every day I am checking our numbers, right? They have their dashboard, they have their software. And they said, and I like to do every new attorney hire that we have, that, you know, 100 and some attorneys, you know, every new attorney hire we do, I like to do the employment agreement. I said, is that, and they're like, just because I like to, right? I like to look at their background. I like to do this. Okay. But they had, to your point, they had two highly compensated, you know, senior managers that had grown and helped them scale. One on ops, right? You know, kind of overall ops, marketing, others, and then really one on the legal side, who was the go-to on the legal. And they really ran into a succession problem because those, you know, senior managers that had come up with them, highly compensated, everything else, were also aging out. So it wasn't that our owner was really motivated to say, hey, you know, this $10 million a year that I get, you know, when I'm in my mountain house or my beach house, you know, and get to travel around. But it's really, we need to take care of this overall. So, you know, succession strategy with management. And so for us, that was a succession need where we explored marketplace options, also internal succession of those management. But yeah, you can't do it alone. Really, you can't do it alone. And I love the fact, you know, we have some attorneys who have created beautiful things, right? Beautiful businesses. And you just, well, you step back and are so impressed. And they're like, well, I'm just an attorney. I could not have done it. Right? Like, I know immigration law, I know this, but, you know, what we built, I had great people around me to help me build that. And, you know, again, going back, it's a hard thing for attorneys to sometimes let go and to delegate and to say, hey, here's a great trusted, you know, outside resource, or I'm going to hire this person. But it's amazing where even if, you know, sometimes those, you know, don't go as planned, but when you find the right one, how that can really help you, you know, truly create value.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. So we spoke about it from the seller standpoint. Now let's think about it from the buyer standpoint, right? We just talked about valuations, et cetera. Well, let's say that we already own a law firm. I like Charlotte, so let's keep talking about Charlotte. Let's say that we do estate planning. Would you recommend that we go ahead and expand our operations by buying a law firm that doesn't do estate planning, but does something else? Or would you rather go and buy another law firm that does estate planning to make it into a one larger estate planning law firm? What's your thinking on that?
Yep. I would first look to building on what we have versus trying to diversify, you know, outside of something, right? To be estate planning and now pull up a corporate practice or do estate litigation or otherwise. I would really try to invest because, as you know, once you really get to a certain scale in revenues, so much other things become possible, right? To say, now we have this awesome operations system, software, and everything else. It didn't make sense when we only had $1.5 million in revenues, but now we've got three and we can really invest to have a full-time person just working on the systems, right? And going from there. And it's not that they need to know estate planning and business corporate and litigation and everything else. We're just focusing on building this and being the best we can about this, the best we can in marketing, the best we can about, you know, client service, on operation efficiency, on our deliverables, everything else. Because I do think, you know, when law firms do multiple things, multiple practice groups, practice areas, to a lot, it's like running multiple businesses within that law firm, right? I mean, I'm sure, you know, for clients that you have and otherwise, like marketing those are different. It's different of how you're going to market this practice service, maybe versus this one.
Not necessarily different, but it's more difficult. And it's almost like marketing two different law firms.
Correct.
And it's harder to convert prospects when your law firm does multiple things because they don't understand whether you're actually good at any one of those things. It is a serious challenge.
And that's some of the hardest practices for us to sell. I mean, smaller geographic market are always tough, but a lot of those smaller geographic are also ones that they just do so much, right? They're multi-practice area. And most of our buyers, to our example, Sasha, they're looking for something they can really take, move on to what they've either built or what they know they want to build, right? And so we have a lot of firms, like we have firms in California, firms in Florida, firms on the East Coast that are really in like estate planning. And their goal is to acquire geographic markets, right? Similar, I tell everybody, similar to like an Edward Jones financial model, right? You have these advisors in the communities, but those firms have built operations and drafting and client advisory and everything else in their main office hub. And so they're able to keep costs low in these, suburban and other geographic markets, but they know the clients are there. And they know that's where the clients are going to come to be serviced and everything else. And they can really scale based on that. If they started to do estate planning and add residential real estate, because it's easy pickings, right? We can just start doing real estate closings. Well, that's a whole nother area. And now you've got to train all your internal systems, but you also have to train your attorneys in these markets, how to do both. And, over time, that may make sense. But initially, I would stay in your lane. Know what you want. Be specific as a buyer. We tell everybody our most qualified buyers are going to be, funded, knowledgeable, have a good team around them of advisors, right, ready to go. But they also really know what they want. When you come into our marketplace and it's, I want everything, like every practice area, every location, you don't really know what you want. And so having a true buyer strategy is a key thing that we work with our buyer prospects to help build, because that's not what's going to just make you successful on the first one, but really hopefully a roll-up series or anything else to make it successful.
So for buyers and for sellers, the three things that appear to be very important: specialization, systems, profit. Those are the key drivers of whether your firm will be sold and whether it will be sold well.
Yep. The only thing I would add to that is, intellectual property, or what I'll call sometimes your uniqueness, right? How unique are you? What is your, how are you different from those other firms in your space? And that could be
on examples.
Yeah, that could be on just brand and marketing. Hey, from this standpoint, everybody else is doing this. This is what we do, right? Or everybody else positions, their marketing message on this. This is how we really position ours. This is our strength. Or it could be, part of that, like we've really built this system and efficiency, from that standpoint that makes us unique, based on that scale or otherwise. But that's why I say uniqueness or intellectual property is because most lawyers, of small law firms don't think about it. But a lot of times, if they can start to really focus on what do they do that's better, that helps them become truly a seller. And also it helps them deliver to a buyer the value that they built. Like messaging means a lot. And it's like, well, I don't know, clients just kind of come and whatever else. But if it's like, this is something we've done for the last 5-10 years in the market that produces clients that, continues to drive everything else and nobody else is really doing, or this is a practice service that we do for our clients that they love, right? Or we do an open house for all of our clients once a year that just out of that, we jump 10%, 20% revenues after it in the months that follow. Just those different uniqueness is so great because, again, a lot of sellers don't think about, well, what makes me wonderful? But you really want to, because that's what's going to, from a buy side, allow them to see why would they buy you versus, the other Joe down the street.
Yeah, I must admit, after years and years and years of working with law firms and having had hundreds, possibly thousands of conversations with law firm owners, it is exceptionally rare for me to see a law firm that actually does something in the unique way that is an actual measurable advantage to their clients or to their firm. It's usually everyone is like, yeah, we also do this. And everybody does that. So it's very rare to see like, we got this thing, nobody does it. There's a substantial benefit to the valuation of our firm. Like you should pay more for this because it's that much better.
Yep. And it's hard going back to the, going back to as lawyers, we're taught to be risk adverse. And so, even our marketplace for buying and selling law firms, years ago, for a lawyer to be the first in selling, right, was, I'm motivated. I want to do this. But, they saw it as a risk. They saw it as all the reasons it won't work or it'll go wrong. And, you know, we have the stories and all the successes and, you know, thankfully, you know, to kind of build and share with others. But, you know, I've kind of adopted a saying, most lawyers don't want to be first. They don't want to create something that they, you know, nobody else, they want to be second, because second is safe. And that's not a knock to, that's not a knock to lawyers. It's just, again, breaking from typically how we've been trained to be advocates for our clients and to really look. And when our clients come with a situation or a problem, we see all the bad scenarios, right? Like, we're going to go through and tell a client, here's something that could go wrong. Here's this, here's that, but we can help, you know, mitigate. And so when we were presented with a business opportunity or anything else, I mean, our brain just goes into that. Here's why it's not going to work, anything else. And so it's hard to jump. It's hard to be first. And we have those stories. But to your point is, yeah, you should be proud to try something unique in your firm, because it will add value. It will. It's sometimes scary. And you're like, I don't know if this is going to work. I don't know if our clients are going to like it. The market's going to like it. But uniqueness can really lead, you know, to firm success, but also in our world, it's going to really be to market value.
One of my last few questions. On your website, you mention here and there for law firms that generate over $2 million in revenue. What is that threshold? What makes, why $2 million, at least $2 million in revenue?
That's really our system, Mark, right? Not for every practice, but for a lot of practices, once they've hit over 2 million, they've had to invest in some systems. They've had to become an owner manager versus a do everything lawyer. And, you know, again, that's not always true. We see $2 million firms that, because of the practice area, the nature of the firm, right, you know, they're still a do everything. But at that point, or really above that, you know, threshold, we start to say, well, as an owner, this is what I do, right? I don't practice law 60 hours a week. I practice law 20 hours a week by reviewing and helping the team and, you know, doing this. I spend my time on management. I spend my time meeting with our marketing team, right? To meet with our, you know, this. And so we start to see that, you know, building business systems, which, as we've spent a lot of time talking about today, builds value. And so the overall aspect of that is, as you build those, right, those deals become higher value, but they also become more complex. You've got typically not just an owner, you know, that's the attorney. You've got the owner with other associates or non-equity partners or otherwise that need to be transitioned over as part of the sale. You've got more complex systems here that, as a buyer, they'll have to do due diligence on, everything else to carry that forward. So those deals typically are just more complex, but they're higher value. And that higher value really comes because they've invested in building and scaling to that. 2 million, you know, again, we used to say that it was probably around 1 million, but we found a lot more firms that could have a lawyer just working 7 days a week, doing everything and generating $1 million in revenue. That's really not, again, those firms can be transacted. And that's, you know, what our marketplace is for, is to help you find an exit and hopefully not work 7 days a week anymore and be able to get value from your firm. But for the, you know, upper level brokerage and really working with, you know, more sophisticated buyers and more sophisticated sellers, that's where we put that 2 million and above. But we love $500,000 in revenue firms as well. And I've been a firm believer of that's why the marketplace is needed. Because look, you know, maybe you haven't invested in those systems and you haven't built that, you know, $5 million firm that our second Joe did. You're the first Joe. But you built value and you deserve to transfer that value to somebody else. And that buyer deserves the benefit of being the acquirer of it, right? To not have them start from zero in your market. Or if they're a young attorney that can come in and take over, great. They don't have to start from zero. That was why you said, you know, you weren't going to start from zero in your new business. And they can be successful because they're going to have mentorship and transition, you know, from that attorney who's been doing it for 20, 30, 40, maybe 50 years. And it can really help them, not just on the legal mentorship, but some of the community and, you know, other things as well.
Do you ever see a situation where there is a partnership 3-4 lawyers, and one of them wants to sell, and somebody from outside wants to buy. And if you see that, how challenging is that transaction and transition usually?
Very challenging.
Very challenging, right? It's crazy.
Very challenging. Yeah. We tell everybody, you know, our typical is we're dealing with solo owners to small partnerships is really our focus. You know, as you and I just talked about, I mean, we have firms that are doing 100 million in revenues. We have firms that are doing a couple hundred thousand. It's just the scale of service or what we're offering. But the goal is to have decision makers or a united front on decision. But we do have, you know, two or three partners that have different timelines on exit. Usually that transaction to bring in one to an already existing partnership, you know, if you got four partners, one wants to retire and you need to bring somebody from the outside, that can be done. I mean, again, you know, recruiters have been doing that for years, you know, trying to place, you know, and kind of build that out. But it can be challenging because you're not just asking, you know, somebody to come over and be a great lawyer. You're asking them to buy into this group of partners, right? And so it's just not buy the whole firm. It's buy this practice or buy into this practice and trust that these other three are ones you want to do business with going forward, right? And so that's a little bit of an extra step versus if you were just a one owner firm, you know, in that situation and transferring, that buyer knows they're coming in and they can do things as they need to. And so usually what we see in those, if you have like a four person, you know, four partner firm, is they'll end up, you know, their sales structure, their retirement really of one may force them into a merger with another firm, which will allow the one partner to retire and be monetized and exited out, right, for their practice value. And the other three will just continue on until they're ready to retire. And then when they're ready to retire, they'll see a similar transaction from that. So we see of the larger partnership groups, much more of merger transactions because you do just get varying timelines based on retirement or exit desire. And that usually provides the cleaner opportunity.
Yeah. My very first business where I had a very successful exit was built with a partner. We did not have a complementary skill set, and it was a difficult journey. We had the same skill set going into the business. My current business, there were two founders, and I bought into an existing business that, again, was around for 10 years when I bought equity in the business, not the entire company. And one of the partners decided to he became a minority shareholder, really very little equity, and he exited from the business. And the other partner is a very active partner. And he and I have very complementary skill set. And that's what I was looking for. So it's a great partnership. And we also, I've known these guys for years before buying into this business. Right. If I didn't, I wouldn't have. I think buying into an existing business where there are partners, it is like marrying multiple people without really knowing them for years. It's probably going to turn into a shit show really quickly. So I would never advise. In fact, every lawyer that I talked to who was thinking about starting their own law firm, I'd be like, advice number one, don't bring on partners. Go at it by yourself.
I mean, to your point, it's very easy to get married, very hard to get divorced, right?
100%. Super expensive.
Yeah, super expensive, you know, in business or in life. And so from that standpoint, it's, yeah, if you can really, you know, keep control and do that, or, you know, really find that ideal partner. And we've dealt with that a lot because we do, you know, advise and have consulting services for succession of internal. And we have a lot of solo owners come to us and say, hey, I've got this associate that's been with me for 5 years. I want to offer them partnership. And, you know, we'll go through a discovery planning process. Why? Well, because they've been with me for 5 years and they do good legal work. But why partnership, right? And they're like, because they've been with me for 5 years and they do good legal work. And we get to say, well, great. That's a good, excellent employee that you want employee retention, you know, compensation structures, anything else, you know, to that point. But are they somebody that is contributing or will contribute really to the value of the business? No, you know, I've really tried them to get to do marketing and do this, but they've never really had an interest in it, right? And, you know, they get their work done, but they go home every Friday at 3:00, right? and, you know, just, you know, different things, right? And so it's hard to sometimes separate and say, look, they're a great, you know, team player. You need them, everything else. But the whole aspect of, in order to retain, I have to make them partnership. You're just trapping yourself, right? You're really trapping yourself in that versus they're great. I need to come up with a good compensation and financial model and understand I value them. Maybe that's non-equity partner role, you know, other things to do that, but really to kind of go forward so you can continue to build out, you know, as you want to. And then again, we see some that are, yeah, absolutely. Like this one over here, they're not just a great, you know, associate, but they're running the marketing team, right? They're doing things better than the current owner and they need, right? You know, they can be complimentary from that side, but those are, you know, those are rare, right? Yeah. It's usually just tenure kind of is thought to be partnership or equity, and that doesn't work well.
Yeah. Tom, you're a wealth of information. I enjoyed this interview so much. I would like to do a part two where we're going to talk about the process of buying, selling, and what really happens in these transactions. Because I've been through a couple of them, and I can tell you from my personal experience, it's been interesting, to say the least, with some discoveries being made throughout the process of selling, and some discoveries that were made after completing the transaction where I bought a business. So I would love to have another hour on the calendar with you where we're going to talk about those things, because if somebody was listening or listening to this podcast right now, listening, watching it, is thinking, oh, that's interesting. I can buy cash flow. I can actually buy profit and pay something like three times of that profit. And it's going to be that simple. It's not. There's a lot that you should know before going in. And you should definitely be working with a team like a broker, accountant, et cetera, an attorney who specializes in mergers and acquisitions. And I would love for you to share some of the stories that you have collected over the years. How does that sound?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'd be delighted to. I've enjoyed, you know, this conversation. Yeah. And I'd love to take it as a step two of, you know, the process, right? And really how that works and, you know, deal killers and missteps and other things we can kind of, you know, discuss throughout that. Because yes, getting to the deal or finding it is great. Getting that deal done the right way is a whole nother aspect, right? And so that's where I tell people, a lot of our sellers say, hey, I already think I have an interested buyer. Great. Wonderful. But a lot of our work in the, you know, the brokerage advisor intermediary service is done, you know, post deal, right? Like really moving through and, you know, making sure that deal can continue to work and how it needs to, you know, be performed through due diligence. So I would love that, Sasha. I'd love to continue the conversation. And this has been great.
Thanks, Tom. I'm looking forward to that conversation.
Absolutely.
Thanks for listening to the Grow Law Firm podcast. If you liked the ideas shared in this episode, help a fellow lawyer out by sharing a link to the episode. This episode is powered by the team of experts in client attraction, growlawfirm.com. Do you want a complimentary growth plan for your law firm? Request it at growlawfirm.com/blueprint.